Good afternoon. This is Michelle Steinberg from Executive Intelligence Review, hosting today's edition of The LaRouche Show, the weekly internet radio broadcast. Today is November 9th, 2002. We've just gotten through the general elections for the U.S. Congress and the Senate, and we have just gotten through a big battle at the United Nations over war with Iraq. This week, Lyndon LaRouche proved to be right again. He was on the mark. LaRouche was the only one who had it right on the elections. He warned Democrats that if they didn't abandon the policies of organized crime-linked Senator Joseph Lieberman, the Democratic Party would go down in flames. That's what happened. We're going to be talking a little bit more about that at the end of today's show, at the end of the hour. The second thing that happened this week is that the United Nations passed a resolution in the Security Council that authorizes weapons inspections for Iraq. In fact, Iraq agreed 2 months ago to allow weapons inspectors to go back into Iraq, but it was the White House who didn't want the war weapons inspectors in there. Now they're authorized to go. Many pundits are saying war is a done deal. War is a fait accompli. Lyndon LaRouche says that's not true. War is not a done deal. We can stop it politically. We can stop it morally. But furthermore, reality can stop that war. We have a bankrupt United States. We can't even afford to pay for education, basic bills to run our nation. How can we afford a war? War is not a done deal. We will be also discussing this week on the organizers' conference call that there are ways, political ways, to get through Lyndon LaRouche's program to stop war from becoming a global catastrophe. But right now, we have another issue to deal with. There is a policy swamp in the United States that is driving this war drive, but it has a weak link. Today's program is going to concentrate in a discussion with my guest, Larry Hecht, from 21st Century Science and Technology Magazine, a long-term collaborator, a long-time collaborator with Lyndon LaRouche. The work that we are doing through EIR on Reverend Sun Young Moon's Gnostic sex cult freak show.
Say it's only a paper moon sailing over a cardboard sea, but it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me.
If you believed in me. Reverend Sun Young Moon, the nightmare of America's parents in the 1970s. Reverend Moon was the zombie maker, the body snatcher, who came in the night or when children were away at college and stole their souls away. There was a lot of basis, and still is, in fact, for this fear. As anyone who has ever looked into the vacant eyes of a Moonie or attempted to converse with one of them, especially now that Reverend Moon is running his mass marriage operation, it is a sex cult. It's bigger than anyone thinks. Larry, why don't you just start by giving us the scope of this Moon operation?
Well, yeah, this is not just some... he's a nutcase, but... he's a very big nutcase and a dangerous one. Moon himself doesn't run the operation, which we'll get into. This is a multi-trillion dollar worldwide apparatus you're dealing with. It's government influence peddling and control of a scale never equaled before in history. Moon literally owns whole countries in South America and Asia, and he's rapidly buying up the U.S. Congress. He may own it right now. The president, opposition forces of the left, right, and center are all in Moon's hands, or at least on his payroll. We came onto this thing when we discovered Moon paying off people we were working with, and among ministers and minority community ministers, reaching into the Islamic community. He bought up Jerry Falwell several years ago, Gary Bauer, the whole religious right is in Moon's hands. So this is a very big operation, and it's an international operation. Now, what we discovered in going back to look at this thing, something what we fleshed out, something that we had known many pieces of for a long time, is that the Moon cult actually derives from two British intelligence operations that date back to the 1920s and 30s. Some of them, they have their origins even a little before that. The first is an outfit called Moral Rearmament, which was founded in 1921 at the Washington Disarmament Conference. H.G. Wells was a delegate to that conference, and Lord Arthur Balfour was the head of the whole British delegation, representing the king. They met with a fellow named Bookman, Frank Bookman, who was nominally a Lutheran preacher from Philadelphia, but had been already for some time an intelligence operative. So that moral rearmament movement, as we'll develop over the course of this show, became, through the intervention of certain operations by H.G. Wells, who, for those of you who don't know, is much more than a science fiction writer, that became Moon's Korean ministry, which then developed into the worldwide Moon operation. The second piece of it, which we'll develop in the second part of the show, is the Unity of Sciences movement. In 1972, Moon started holding yearly conferences, which continue to this day, called the International Conference on the Unity of the Sciences, ICUS. That Unity of Science movement had started in the mid-1930s under the leadership of Lord Bertrand Russell and John Dewey. So the Moon movement actually is bringing together of those two operations, and that's the story we've got to tell today.
Okay, you've said a lot there. Buying up Congress, maybe they own it already. And back in the 1970s, this was investigated. We've been talking about one little operation called the Pretty Girls. What's that all about?
Oh yeah, well, the way I knew it was the well, there's the Little Angels. Oh, yeah. Back in 1989, under the first Bush administration, you had a scandal in Washington. The newspapers referred to it as the Congressional Madam Scandal. It seemed there were 300 or so prostitutes operating under this Congressional Madam by the name of Tung Sun Park. She had another name I can't recall right now. According to military intelligence investigators that we had talked to at the time, there were some very nasty photographic evidence of this is an influence peddling operation. This thing reached very high up into the military, which was why military intelligence came into it. High-level, high-ranking officers of the military and high-ranking officials of our government essentially being used in the way that these things work. It was a sexual bribery type operation. Moon had the Little Angels is the Korean girls, Asian girls choir that Moon runs, and these were apparently part of the bait for this thing.
Now, what about his own history? We've heard Lynn, Mr. LaRouche, speaking like last week to a cadre school of the youth movement, in which he says that Moon had been jailed for sex crimes up in Korea. What is that? does that mean for a religious cult? I mean, how's that working?
Well, you know, Moon himself is what they call a synthetic personality in the intelligence trade. This is the kind of person. Moon was born in mid 1920s. He had some engineering training in the late 30s. Remember that Korea was under Japanese occupation that time, long before the war. Moon had been jailed in a Japanese internment. Then, as the Korean War developed, Moon was subjected to hideous jailing and brainwashing in the famous North Korean camps, which many American people heard about in the early 50s. This Korean brainwashing. Moon calls his conversion to so-called conversion to Christianity my brainwashing. So this is some sick stuff. This is the actual belief structure of the Moon cult is classic Gnostic heresy, straight classic. That's what Moon is, and he seems to have a little penchant for young girls, or did in his younger days. The Moon theology, it's a nut operation. You go to a Moon meeting, and on the podium are always there's an announcement, Father and Mother Moon. Moon believes that, he calls it the Third Testament Age. Moon believes he's a Messiah. If you join the Moonie operation, you join into a blessed marriage that makes you part of a new family that overcomes the sin of Adam and Eve, and you are part of a new generation. So this is a race cult among other things. If you want to get an idea of here's a speech. I mean, here's something. Here's a little quote from Moon. Remarkably, this one, he says something like this, from what I've been able to determine, at pretty much every major public appearance. But this he actually made at an ICUS conference, an International Conference of Unity of Sciences, in 1986 in Washington, D.C. So you had Nobel Prize-winning physicists there. You had Eugene Wigner, the nuclear scientist, Fred Seitz, top names in physics and chemistry and in biology, Sir John Eccles, neuroscientist, and so forth. And we'll get into what they're doing there a little later on. Here's Moon's philosophy of life, let's say. Then we quote from Moon. The purpose of life into which we all are born, for a man is woman and for a woman is man. Man and woman are born to live for each other. The harmony of their body shapes and of their organs of love are simply made so. If you truly understand this fact, you have mastered more truth and more precious wisdom than an entire encyclopedia. God, the great King of Wisdom, has placed our organs of love in each other's custody. Thus, the true master of the organ of love which a man or woman possesses is not that person's at all, but is their loving spouse.
I have to add to that. I don't have any quotes at hand, but I have been looking into the Moonies for years, and there are literally hundreds of speeches in which Moon goes on and on at great length about the physical organs themselves, the bodily processes and bodily fluids and defecation and so forth, and how you have to love your body and so forth. But there's something else that you said. He thinks he's the Messiah. I discussed this with Jeff Steinberg a few weeks ago on another aspect of the Moonies, but I think it's worth reiterating. According to Moon, as recently as July 4th, 2002, in the Washington Times, he printed his conversation that he had with Almighty God, in which God said to him, Reverend Moon, it's a good thing we have you around, because my other son, Jesus Christ, was a big failure. He allowed himself to be crucified before he had children, before he used his organ to create this pure race.
Yeah.
And listeners, let me go a little further with this. According to Moon's belief structure, all human beings are evil because we stem from Adam and Eve, and Eve was impregnated by the snake in the Garden of Eden, by Satan. Therefore, we are all children of Satan. Now, people can these days believe what they want, especially in an era where there is no truth, which I think this is what Moon is attacking by buying up all of these scientists, the very idea of truth. But on the other hand, he has this specific theology, and yet he is buying up religious leaders across the country. And from what I've heard, their answer is, oh, I don't believe this stuff. I'm just taking the money. Mm. Have you encountered anything like that in what you've reviewed?
Well, that's exactly, yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. It's straight out corruption. It's a Gnostic cult. Anybody who calls themselves a member of any of the major religions, a Christian, a Jew, a Muslim, and they're on the take for Moon. These people are up on the podium with Moon all the time. I was surprised. In 1996, Louis Farrakhan of the Nation of Islam was on the podium with Moon, sharing the podium with Thornburg, the Attorney General, a former Attorney General. So this is everywhere and it's widespread. So Moon didn't invent this. Maybe we should start getting into what this what this thing really is.
Absolutely.
Moon is a sick case. He's a synthetic personality that they wind up to this cult operation. He's not the only such cult operation by any means, by the way. And maybe it's worth saying that this what is Gnosticism? Gnosticism was the we know it from early Christian times. It actually was around long before that. It came out of Babylon. Babylon. Gnosticism comes from the Greek word gnosis, which means knowledge. But it has nothing to do with knowledge. It doesn't mean that you, something to do with knowing God. It has to do with secret revealed knowledge. The Gnostic cults are built around secrets. Generally, they involve there's a great variety of among them. They involve they have this worship of the number seven, which came out of the Babylonian worship of the sun, the moon, and the planets. I'm looking into whether I don't think that his name. I think the name itself is synthetic. You've got sun, myung, moon. I'm looking into the origin of that too. So you've got it's a Gnostic cult operation with a sex cult side of it. The use of the obsession, his own obsession with sex and the use of sex for bait, and then these horrible the so-called moon blessed marriages, where you become a member of this new Third Testament age family. But what's even more surprising, really, that's the horror show side of it. But what's really even more surprising, what we got into in this, is that the Moon operation comes out of this association called Moral Rearmament, which itself comes out of the schemes of Bertrand Russell and H.G. Wells that go back really to the very beginning of the 20th century. With the British had a problem, and that problem, just to locate it historically very briefly, what happened in what happened at Appomattox was the beginning of a new kind of problem for the British, because they had hoped with the Civil War to balkanize the United States, to break up the United States, and achieve what they had lost in 1783. What happened was that the United States emerged as a land power on the North American continent. An army that could not be defeated, with an industrial base and a scientific technological base that was very shortly to going to surpass the British. So what they realized was that the only way the thing was going to be defeated now, they had to turn from ideas of warfare to of the military type to subversion. So. Subversion. The point was that the British had to, the Civil War, the U.S. Lincoln's victory in the Civil War and of course they had him assassinated just weeks after Appomattox, meant they had to turn to subversion. So let's spin ahead to history to H.G. Wells and Bertrand Russell. Now, H.G. Wells and Lord Bertrand Russell were members of the elite level of the British planning group. First it had the name the Coefficients Club from about 1902 to 1908. Then they adopted the name the Round Table. Milner's Kindergarten was another name for it, the Cliveden Set. Pretty much this was the same operation all along. The question was, how do you destroy the United States? How do you keep the nations of Europe from the possible alliance of Russia with Germany, with France, with Japan, that had been the U.S. strategic policy? How do you break that up?
Can you give us a year or decade on this?
World War One. Let's take World War One was one level of implementation of this thing. And the British organized World War One. Not every member of the set agreed with it, but Russell thought it could be done. Bertrand Russell thought it could be done another way. But now let's come up to the 1920s. I mentioned 1921 and the founding of this organization called Moral Rearmament, which leads into the Moon Cult. Then let's go to 1928. H.G. Wells writes a best-selling book called, it went through three different printings, called The Open Conspiracy. Here is Wells's outline of what is to be done in the program of the open conspiracy. It comes down to three issues. I'll just read them. They're one sentence each. This is his summary. Firstly, the entirely provisional nature of all existing governments and the entirely provisional nature, therefore, of all loyalties associated therewith. These are the points which you agree on if you're a member of the open conspiracy. Secondly, the supreme importance of population control in human biology and the possibility it affords us of a release from the pressure of the struggle for existence on ourselves. And thirdly, the urgent necessity of protective resistance against the present traditional drift towards war. So there you have it. Break down national sovereignties in order to create a world government. All of the governments surrender their, you know, disarm themselves, submit to weapons inspectors, if you heard of anything like that, and so forth. And there's an international body, which is guess who actually run the thing. So secondly, population control, human biology, this gets into the unity of sciences question, the whole control of the biological sciences and the directing of this thing into proving that there is no soul, that there is no such thing even as life, that everything is materialism, pure basic materialism. That was the ideology of the unity of sciences movement. And thirdly, a mass draft resistance movement. Well, believe it or not, that's what they were promoting. That's what Moral Rearmament took the lead in promoting this in the 1930s. There was a movement called the Oxford Movement, or the Oxford Pledge, which was a mass movement among students in Britain, across Europe, which, remember, the devastation of World War One was 8.5 million people dead, 37 million casualties at the end of World War One, and then that many dead died again in the 5 or so years afterwards from typhus, diphtheria. It was a scourge what happened to Europe. So there was certainly an opening to go for peace, but you know, how were you going to get it? Well, their way was get people to renounce their sovereignty, renounce their loyalty to any country. So this was a mass movement among college students, including in the United States. It reached a high point about 1938, when there were mass demonstrations of 30,000 and more students in New York and California, in the USA, signing this pledge. That was Wells and Russell's operation, and that was run by Moral Rearmament. Now, just jump ahead. Now, 1952, you have Moral Rearmament newsletter. You have a description of an island called Jinudo. Off the Korean island, off the coast by the Natkong River in Korea. On this island, you have a group of orphans who have been organized around the principles of moral rearmament. They had their slogans, absolute true, absolute honesty, absolute unselfishness, absolute purity, absolute love. Those were the principles of moral rearmament. This was an interesting case. The head of the Frank Buckman, the head of this thing, was a very slick operative. Buckman included among his what he had the ability to do. He was unmarried all his life. He carried this posture of uprightness and probity. And what he would do was he would insinuate himself into the confidence of people, and not just ordinary people, but high-level leaders. He included Himmler and Rudolf Hess among his confidants. After the war, he even such good people as de Gasperi of Italy and Adenauer, the Chancellor of Germany, were nominally members of this moral rearmament. This was a very high-level penetration operation. He got free pass from General Lucius Clay to go into post-war Germany and operate freely. He was credited with having created the French-German rapprochement after the war. But what this guy, what this guy really was an operative of the open conspiracy, set off directly by Wells in this 1921 meeting in Washington. So you have this organization of Korean orphans, this moral rearmament thing operating within Korea in the Korean War, and this by means we don't exactly know, because you're never going to find out every detail of it, because this was a military intelligence operation. This thing, Moon, is picked up and channeled into this moral rearmament thing. That's the 50s. It's still pretty small, and it was around that time that Moon had gotten one of his morals charges, for sex with minors. It's still pretty small. It starts to grow really big in the early 1960s. They send feelers over to the United States. They start setting up businesses here, and it basically the mid 60s. It's the a lot of the business front operations are set up. Remember, they also run. They were already running Korean munitions plants. The KCIA, the Korean Central Intelligence Agency, was exposed in our congressional hearings as running the Moon operation.
We're coming up on a break we have to take right now. You're listening to The LaRouche Show for November 9th, Saturday. Larry Hecht, our guest and author of an upcoming blockbuster article on the Moon cult, has just told us about the Wells Moon Frank Buckman operation, where anti-war is war, war is peace, peace is war, and this comes right up to the Iraq war issue we're facing today. We'll be back in a minute, during which time I'd like to invite the conference organizers' conference line to give some questions to your moderator, Marcia Baker, if you have any questions, which she'll relay to us. We're having some technical difficulties, which we can overcome that way. I'd like to tell people now about EIR's new report. EIR has issued a LaRouche special report on science and infrastructure. It's a 88-page report with 32 maps, 17 diagrams, which goes through what needs to be done for the economy. Lyndon LaRouche, who's the founding editor of the EIR and pre-candidate for the Democratic Party presidential nomination in 2004, this fall launched an emergency mobilization for infrastructure, beginning with rescuing and expanding the passenger rail and air transport systems of the United States, which are bankrupt. No amount of money being paid into these companies, United Airlines, Amtrak, American Airlines, which is going to pay old debt, can save the system. So what is to be done? That is answered in LaRouche's Emergency Infrastructure Program for the United States. This report is available for $75 via purchase by telephone at 1-888-EIR-3258 or on the internet at the LaRouche Publications store at www.larouchepub.com. I'd like to come back to our show right now, our special program on Reverend Sun Myung Moon.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore. When the world seems to shine like you've had too much wine, that's amore.
Okay, when there's more than pizza pie is going to hit with the moon crowd in power in Washington. So, Larry, let's recap what we've gone over for the last few minutes. We have a moral rearmament or disarmament movement that goes back to a high point of 1938. So this is an anti-war movement that includes Heinrich Himmler of the Nazi Party, who is overrunning all of Europe. That should tell you something, shouldn't it?
Yeah.
And people are falling for this. And today, Moon has what? 200 different front groups?
I've heard it's a single-space list of 27 pages.
A single-space list of 27 pages. Single-space, that's 50 lines a page. We're dealing with 1,000 front groups.
Yeah.
And many of them have the word peace in it.
Yeah.
But his closest collaborators involve organizations like JINSA in the United States, the Chicken Hawks Nest, Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, the Washington Times, which is the most rabid warmongering newspaper in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a situation where black is white, white is black, reality doesn't matter. You mentioned Russell and Wells.
Yes.
Let's remind people about Bertie Russell and his view.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, I was in high school and then junior high school in the late 1950s. That's when I first heard of Bertrand Russell. In fact, I had a teacher in the 11th or 12th grade who gave us Russell's unpopular essays to read. There were a lot of fans of Russell's among the intellectual class. In fact, my father had four or five of his books. Well, Russell, I thought, was a pacifist. I knew Russell. I didn't necessarily agree with him. He was promoting, but he seemed to be a leader of the movement against the bomb and the whole peace movement. He was there in London. He was always at big demonstrations, the ban the bomb demonstrations and so forth. Then when the Vietnam War started, he became a big leader of the Vietnam War. In fact, the very first movement in the United States against the Vietnam War, run by a Haverford College student named Russell Stettler, was he had gone over to England to become a disciple of Russell's. But this leader of the peace movement, it turns out in the period from 1945 to 1949, was calling for a preemptive nuclear strike against Russia, against the Soviet Union. He wanted to bomb every Russian city into oblivion. So much for peace. Wells, again, well, these are both very unsavory characters and personally unsavory characters, and their personal unsavoriness goes together with their, you know, with their views. Their view of humanity is a degraded one, and Russell is also well known, perhaps to those of you who read our publications as well. Russell is well known for having called for population control is one of their concerns. They somehow think there's too many of us, and Wells has called for such things as a plague,
once every generation,
disease every generation to sweep across the earth to thin the ranks of humanity. All you have to do really is read Wells's science fiction works, and you see his view of humanity. I mean, it's a terrible thing because these works are so popular. His political writings today are not as well known, but The Time Machine, the War of the Worlds, The Invisible Man is one of his early works, which I went back and read recently. I'll read a little passage from that so you get an idea of this man's thinking. He's an engaging writer, but this is his view of, well, the story of the Invisible Man. You've got a fellow named Griffin, a medical student, who is clearly Wells. This is autobiographical. This is written when he's about one of his first successes. He's about 30 years old. Wells himself, you should know. Where does Wells come from? Russell is an influential on his own. Russell is from a British noble family that goes back to the first Earl of the first Russell Earl of Bedford came to prominence under Henry VIII. So that's 300 or 400 years. Wells was a commoner. Wells's father was a gardener. His mother was a house servant. He was picked up about the age of, he was a bright young fellow, and picked up about the age of 18 when he attended college under scholarship, and his teacher was a man named Thomas Huxley. That's the grandfather of Julian and Aldous Huxley. Julian Huxley was the so-called straight Huxley, the biologist, the collaborator of Wells in a book called The Science of Life, which is a hideous appeal to the use of biology for the control of essentially what developed into the ideas of genetics, genetic control for the purpose of controlling humanity. Huxley, we're back into the 1880s. Huxley was the man who promoted the career of Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin was a recluse. The reason they picked him up was in order to promote the idea, a social doctrine, which was the doctrine of survival of the fittest, the dog-eat-dog world that you might have heard people talking about once in a while. So it was the use of, it was the use of science. It's an old story. And that's really how I got into this, to find out where this rottenness in science came from. It was the use of science to promote evil social goals. So here we are. So that's how Wells is trained and sets off a writing career and becomes an adopted member of the British ruling classes, and essentially played the role of publicist for these ideas. So here we are, his book, The Invisible Man, from 1897. It's clearly autobiographical. Griffin is a medical student, as Wells was, and he's discovered the secret to how to make living matter invisible, how to make things disappear. So he experiments first on a cat. It happens to be his landlady's cat. She's a bit upset about that. The cat disappears. So then he decides he's going to do it himself, and he puts himself through this procedure. It's very painful. He succeeds. He's become invisible. So now he's going back. He's telling his story. He has a lot of trouble being invisible. He has to walk around London in the winter naked, you know. So he's now gone to a small town to escape the problems there. He meets up with he's robbed a lot of places in order to survive. He meets up with a former fellow medical student by the name of Kemp in the small town, and realizes he needs some help. Tries to bring him in on the his little conspiracy. Here's him speaking to Kemp about the discovery. To do such a thing would be to transcend magic. And I beheld, unclouded by doubt, a magnificent vision of all that invisibility might mean to a man. The mystery, the power, the freedom. Drawbacks I saw none. And, after 3 years of secrecy and exasperation, I found that to complete it was impossible. Impossible! How? Asked Kemp. Money, said the invisible man, and went again to stare out the window. He turned round abruptly. I robbed the old man, robbed my father. The money wasn't his, and he shot himself. For a space, Griffin sat silent, and then he resumed abruptly. I went to bury him. My mind was on this research, and I did not lift a finger to save his character. I remember walking back to the empty home, through the place that had once been a village and was now patched and tinkered by the jerry builders into the ugly likeness of a town. Every way the roads ran out at last into the desecrated fields and ended in rubble heaps and rank wet weeds. I remember myself as a gaunt black figure going along the slippery, shiny pavement, and the strange sense of detachment I felt from the squalid respectability, the sordid commercialism of the place. I did not feel a bit sorry for my father. He seemed to me to be the victim of his own foolish sentimentality. The current cant required my attendance at his funeral, but it was really not my affair. That's Wells. That's Wells all the way through his personal life. He was married several times and carried on one affair after another. As part of the story is told very well in a recent book by a Canadian, which recounts the story of how Wells stole the book that actually made his wealth, was his Outline of History, published about 1920-21. Well, it turns out Wells stole the book. He stole the manuscript from a Canadian woman by the name of Florence Deeks, and the book that made his fame. So,
if I could just dwell on one point you made. These guys, H.G. Wells, Bertrand Russell, members of the Coefficients Club, out to save the British Empire, believe that science works for power, for control, for evil.
Exactly.
That's exactly the opposite of what Lyndon LaRouche and our whole movement believes.
Exactly.
Larry, we are relatively flooded with questions here that have come in by email, so let's go to a couple of these if we can. First is Elizabeth from Washington. She was listening on as you're developing the Oxford University story and asks, who was the fund paying for what was going on in the 1928 to 1952 period at Oxford and other places bearing on this?
Well, this was, I mean, you get a movement like that going, this is the decision on the part of the top, the oligarchy, that they're going to promote this thing. So the offices of the universities and so forth are devoted to it. You get students, susceptible and gullible students, pulled into the thing. That's how you create a mass movement. The same way as they did it in, as I saw it being done in the late 60s with the anti-war movement here, which I myself joined and soon discovered was a manipulated operation.
But these things, as you're mentioning, the anti-war movement in the United States, as we've researched over the years and uncovered in our battle with fighting for a republic, we've found that things are not what they seem. What appears to be a independent mass movement turns out to be secretly financed by the Ford Foundation. We ran into that. That the terrorist wing of the anti-war student movement, the Weathermen, at Columbia, that you and Lynn and Tony Papert were involved against. They were backed by the Ford Foundation.
Yes, exactly. Well, look, you've got the major publishing houses of the British Empire publishing the literature of Wells. That's how this thing works. It's a mass phenomena. They're promoting his open conspiracy. They're promoting his Outline of History, this filth, on a mass scale. And that is, that's what brings in the Mickeys into the thing. That's how they operate. A Russell, it's the same thing. They're promoting these characters. You could promote other people. So, and Russell, it's an interesting thing, because you were talking about our ideas versus them. Russell's begins his career, he's coming out of the Cambridge Aristotelian Society. This is the late 1890s. Russell is supposedly a philosopher. If you read his philosophy, you realize, you understand it's garbage if you know something about philosophy. But Russell begins his career attacking who? Attacking Leibniz, his first major work, published actually still in school, and then it was published as a limited circulation book, and it's available now, his study of Leibniz, the philosophy of Leibniz, I think is the title of it. He decides that he first of all, Russell is a pure Aristotelian. Everything is to be reduced to logic. Everything can be reduced to logical statements or mathematical logical statements in the extreme. So he goes through Leibniz and decides. Now, if you've ever read Leibniz, just think how ridiculous this is. He goes through the greatest philosopher of modern times and decides that all of his ideas can be reduced to five axioms. But then, in looking through the vast bulk of Leibniz's published writings, he realizes that everything Leibniz says is inconsistent with these five axioms. So, does Russell reject his five axioms? No. What does he decide? He decides that, Leibniz was just a liar, like Russell himself. He couldn't think of nothing else. And Leibniz was just faking it with all of his stuff about the pursuit of happiness and the goodness of man and God and so forth. He's just lying about it. Really, everything that he really believed was only in the special particular correspondence called the Letters to Arnault. which of course they themselves don't even fit Russell's profile, but because he's discussing things with a man of Aristotelian training, Russell can sort of fit it in. So this is how this kind of thing works.
You're listening to The LaRouche Show. This is, you've heard Larry Hecht from 21st Century Science and Technology. I'm going to ask Larry to, before we take any other questions, Larry, you have written a number of very important pieces on the positive side of science,
right.
How science has contributed to humanity and the fact that the human race would still be running around in caves and animal skins without scientific breakthroughs. I know we have a number of students who are listening in now or will be in the archive. Mm-hmm. Give us a rundown of some of your major articles.
Good.
And where to find them on
Good.
The web.
Good. Well, yeah, and that fits in because I was just about to say Russell's other attack was on Riemann, Bernard Riemann. The most important student of Carl Friedrich Gauss, and the man whose studies of geometry Lyndon LaRouche realized were completely coherent with his view of physical economy. And LaRouche, having first independently developed his views, then realized the resonance of his works with Riemann. So Riemann was born in 1826, died very young in 1866. Before it even reached his 40th birthday, is the most famous modern mathematician of the 19th century, a towering figure in mathematics, the student of the most towering figure of modern mathematics, Carl Friedrich Gauss. So, this is whom Russell chose to attack in his other first early work, Leibniz and then Riemann. So that's who Russell is. My work, I had a little furlough for 6 years in the Huskel back from 1993 to 1999. So I had the opportunity to, there were more than a dozen of us who went to jail, some of us with Lynn in the federal case, others which I was part of in the state of Virginia case, and others elsewhere. Anyway, I did just under 6 years, so I used the time as best I could. I was quite interested in some questions of science, and I looked especially into in the history of science, the work of Wilhelm Weber, who was the other a collaborator of Gauss and of Riemann in electrodynamics. And I found out that the whole story of electrodynamics, anybody who studies physics gets into Maxwell's equations and the Faraday-Maxwell theory, was all garbage. That was all an attempt, just like the Russell. It's what gave me the sense to be able to go at this. My study of that is what gave me the critical ability to be able to look at what the subject that we're talking about now and evaluate it clearly. So I did this work. I did a number of pieces on the work of Weber. That took me back to André-Marie Ampère and the work of Augustin Fresnel, the French side of this thing. This was the positive side of science in the early 19th century. The other part of this British operation was to take its cultural warfare, its intellectual warfare, and it was to take over science. To destroy German science, to destroy French science. They did it one way in France, they did it another way in Germany. The key figures in the destruction in Germany were Helmholtz, Ernst Mach, who appears as a leading figure, a icon of the unity of science movement. And if you study the science today, you get, for example, well, let me just, you asked me to say where to get this. Our website, so I'm the editor of 21st Century Science and Technology magazine. Our website is www.21st, that's 21st, 21stcenturyscientetech.com, 21stcenturyscientetech.com. And we've got a link to the website on the LaRouche Show website. If you study science in school today, the first book they'll throw at you is called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions by Thomas S. Kuhn. I found this book very interesting. I read it back about 1972, 73. So I took a look at it again. I open it up. What do I find? This book was published as volume 2 of the International Encyclopedia of Unified Science. Advisory Committee. Niels Bohr one of the most evil men of modern science, John Dewey, and Bertrand Russell, and many other names, which I can tell you a little bit about too, but maybe we should get some more questions. Ernst Nagel, who ran the operation against Gödel, Rudolf Carnap and Otto Neurath, the founders of the Vienna Circle. So should we get into that now or take another question?
Well, we're not going to have time to go through all of that, but
you're going to have to wait and see my article in one of the upcoming issues of EIR this week.
EIR. We hope that the article by Larry Hecht and the research team on the moonification of sciences will be out in print in EIR in 2 weeks from Friday, actually. We do have two more questions. This is Steve from Canada, who is a Lourdes supporter. Steve says, during the recent elections, the Lieberman faction within the Congress and Senate was weakened and replaced by the Republicans. Does this mean that the Moonies are also weakened? And what does this change in the government mean for the possibility of the LaRouche movement gaining more power within the Democratic Party? I have a second question also. Does a Republican control of the government mean that the war faction has more power?
Well, that's a good question.
Very good. Multiple good question.
Well, maybe Michelle has something to say about it too. I'll just say the Moonies are ripe for the picking. I mean, this is a tactical initiative. It tells the study that we're doing tells us a great deal about the history of the whole century. We need to know it. We need to know it in its strategic depth. As a tactical initiative, yes. Look, they're out there. They're exposed. This is a Gnostic sex cult out there buying up the President of the United States, the Congress, and the leading televangelists. So and then now civil rights figures. So yeah, we think we can break off the Moonies, absolutely, and the Lieberman, the weakness of the Lieberman operation should help us to do it. Maybe you want to say something.
I do have a quote from Lynn just before the election, and to Steve, answer yes, the possibility of the LaRouche movement gaining more power within the Democratic Party is enormous right now. It is enormous. And various top-level people in the Democratic Party have told Lyndon LaRouche privately, look, just declare victory. Every single person who lost in the elections lost because they went along with either Joe Lieberman directly, Dick Gephardt directly, or the Michael Steinhardt organized crime figure who is behind Lieberman, his group called the Democratic Leadership Council. So now the Democratic Party is looking very, very seriously, and the members of the Democratic Party, they're facing the fact that they gave this election to Bush. And that means a big opening for us. This is what Lyndon LaRouche said on November 1st. He called it. He said, what the Democratic Party has done to this nation and its people is a crime against our people and their posterity. Either the party abandons those its presently continuing habits of the recent 25 years, or it is soon dead. It can no longer get by with the swindle the leadership of the party has been running over these decades. The worst thing is not that the party leadership has policies which are evil, such as those of Lieberman, or practically impotent. Some of the leaders could be changed under appropriate top-down leadership. But the present crew of the Democratic Party is not capable of doing anything relevant on its own. Without new leadership top-down, the party has no moral relevance. No moral relevance. If the Democratic Party were not now to reverse its policies and specifically adopt my FDR style remedies, the nation would not survive. Otherwise, neither that party, the Democratic Party, nor the nation have a snowball's chance in hell during the several years immediately ahead. Lynn said that on November 1st. On the day of the election, November 5th, he was going into a meeting which you'll hear more about next week, where LaRouche was the invited guest at some leading meetings in Mexico, in the state of Sierra Leone, in which he was addressing audiences of 500 students on the economic crash. First time Lynn's been back in Mexico in 20 years. But that day he had discussions with leading Democrats in which he posed a solution to this mess. It's called the Super TVA, the Super Tennessee Valley Authority, a program of the FDR across the country to rebuild dams, rivers, bridges, high-speed rail lines, etc. That's what we'll be talking about in the weeks ahead. Already we have commitments from some state representatives to hold hearings on this issue. All right, we have only a few minutes left. I want to also take a question from Lester in Texas. Very important question. The news today is that the United Nations approved the resolution for war on Iraq. What does Lynn say about this? What Lynn said in discussions with EIR and our executive committee last night is there were obviously a lot of discussions and a deal was made where countries that oppose the war, like Russia and France, they have not dropped their opposition to the war. They got private assurances. A deal was made. The war is not inevitable. And anybody who says that the war is inevitable and cannot be stopped at this point right now is working for the war faction. Now, there's no question that it would be better if it were stronger that the UN had passed something prohibiting preventive war actions, but that didn't happen. Nonetheless, what Lynn said on September 11th, that there were three hurdles. One, get Bush to the UN. Two, get a UN resolution that would be acceptable to Bush in Iraq and to Iraq. That's where we are right now. Larry, I'm going to give you the last word. You have less than a minute, but why don't we just restate how important this Mooney issue is?
Okay, well, the essential thesis is we'll be you know, spelling it out more in the IR piece in upcoming weeks. The Moon operation is this is a worldwide empire of influence, peddling, and control. The Moon operation goes back, is derived out of a British intelligence operation that goes back to the 20s and 30s, moral rearmament and the unification of the sciences. If you want to understand really what this whole thing is, that's what it is. On the surface, it is what it appears to be. It's a Gnostic sex cult. The Mooney, the unleashing of the Mooney freak show, which hit our college campuses here back in the 70s, was intended to brainwash the American people.
You've been listening to The LaRouche Show for November 9th. Please join us next week at this time.